I was first introduced to the Five Buddha Mandala when I first started coming along to the centre about 15 years ago. And I had a very strong response to it straight away, not just positive actually. I did feel immediately drawn to Omega Siddhi, the Buddha of the North. There were a couple of other figures in the mandala that I felt quite wary of, quite cautious about initially, although that's changed over the years. And, well, for quite a few years, I sort of explored those figures, particularly the four on the periphery of the mandala. I really enjoyed exploring them individually, looking at their symbolism and trying to relate that to my life, and also sort of looking at how they relate to each other. But for a long time, the centre of the mandala was a complete blank to me. I had no idea what was going on in there. And that's how it stayed, really, until the night before my private ordination. And that night I had a dream. I dreamt I was walking through a landscape of snow. There was just snow in all directions as far as I could see, and above me just the open sky. And there was something about the snow. It had some qualities. It wasn't ordinary snow. The first thing about it was there was something about the colour white and the texture of it. It was just deeply beautiful, and it really affected me. And then the other thing, which is a bit odd, is that it seemed to be radiating kindness. And I don't know what it was, but it just filled me with bliss. And I remember waking up feeling completely blissful. And also a bit puzzled, actually, because I'd never really connected with the colour white, with white figures like Vairochana. I suppose they'd always seemed a bit bland and featureless to me. But the colour white in that dream was just different. And then the following evening, I had my private ordination, and Samatha gave me my name, Dateshvari, which is short for Akasha Dateshvari, who's the female figure in the centre of the mandala. And I guess with the name and the dream, I just thought, I feel like I'm being invited to explore the centre of the mandala and to find out what actually does happen in there. So this is what this talk is going to be about. I'm going to start off just describing the two figures quite briefly. And then talk about, entering the centre of the mandala and entering that space. Then I'll talk about Vairochana, and I'm going to talk about him in his aspect as the archetypal king. And then I'll move on to the wisdom of the centre of the mandala, which is embodied by Akasha Dateshvari. So to describe them, we've got them both on the shrine here. Vairochana, first of all. So his name means the illuminator. So he has all the whole symbolism around Vairochana is very strongly associated with the sun. He's white in colour, and he sits in the Vajra posture, so that's the full lotus posture. He's clothed in white, and he has black hair. And he's sitting on a white lotus, which is supported by lions. So each of the Buddhas is associated with an animal, and for Vairochana it's the lion. For the four Buddhas on the outside of the mandala, all of them are associated with a direction of space or a time of day. Vairochana's a bit different. He's, in a way you could say he's associated with the whole of space, so no one particular direction, just space as a whole. And he doesn't have a particular time of day. In a way he goes beyond time. He belongs to the Buddha family, or the Tathagata family, and his hands are in the gesture of teaching, which is something like this. And he holds the golden Dharma chakra, the Dharma wheel. So within his mudra, he's holding the Dharma wheel. And the Dharma wheel itself is a symbol of the Dharma. He's associated with the poison of ignorance. So that means spiritual ignorance. So that's what he counteracts. So that's Varuchana. Akasha Dateshwari is the female figure who sits in that realm. Her name means queen of the realm of space. And when we're talking about space in this context, it's really it's inner space. It's not space out here, it's the inner dimension. So she's also white in colour. She sits in the same Vajra posture. She's also clothed in white, but her robes are richly adorned. And she's also wearing jewels and ornaments. And she wears a five-jeweled crown on her head, the colours of the five Buddhas. She's got long black hair, and part of it is tied up in a top knot. And there's a little figure of Virochana sitting in her hair. She has the same mudra as Virochana, but she doesn't hold the Dharma chakra. She holds the stems of two pale blue lotuses. So in her right hand, she holds the stem of a lotus that blossoms over here above her right shoulder. And on that lotus sits a golden Dharma wheel. And then in her left hand, she's holding the stem of another lotus that blossoms above her left shoulder. And on that lotus, there's a silver Vajra bell. So all of the female figures of the mandala actually have this Vajra bell. It's a symbol of wisdom. So all of the female figures are wisdom figures. Visantra's written pujas to all of the female figures. And in the one on Akasha Dateshwari, he describes her as regal, intensely beautiful, serene and smiling. So that's all I'll say about the figures really and how they look. There's quite a bit written about them in different books. Visantra's written about both figures. Then there's some material in Lama Govinda's Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. And Francesca Freemantle's written some really interesting chapters on all of the Buddhas in her book Luminous Emptiness. So Virochana and Akasha Dateshwari are said to be in the same relation to each other as the sun and the space that sunlight illuminates. And just like with all the figures in the mandala, the male figure always represents compassion and the female figure represents wisdom. So together, these two represent these two aspects of the enlightened mind. Again, as with all of the jhanas, they're all said to sort of stem from a particular episode in the life of the historical Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni. And with Virochana, it's the teaching of the first sermon at the deer park in Sarnath. So the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dharma, the discourse that the Buddha gave. So you could say that Virochana, in a way, embodies the teaching aspect of Shakyamuni Buddha, or the communication of the Dharma. So that's his compassionate activity, the sharing and the teaching of the Dharma. And Virochana is also the first lineage patriarch of the Shingon school of Buddhism, which is the Japanese school founded by Kukai in the 8th or 9th century. So he's an important figure in Japanese Buddhism. So, as Aryajaya said, I've always had a very strong response to archetypal figures and this sort of mythic realm. And I was thinking what it is that attracts me. It's not about having sort of beautiful figures out there to look at. It's about finding ways of relating those figures to my experience and bringing them alive in my own practice. Just looking for ways of doing that. Really, I suppose, trying to get under their skin or letting them get under mine. So the questions that come up when I think about figures like these are things like, how does it feel to inhabit their realm? how can I learn to see through their eyes? How can I learn to become them, really? And, well, before we can find out how it feels to be in Vairochana's realm, we need to figure out how to get in there. And I think one way of entering the centre of the mandala is, well, to cultivate the qualities of that realm. So the qualities of the centre are openness, receptivity, stillness, simply being, presence. So cultivating those qualities will allow us to enter that space. Now, a couple of months ago, my life started to get really busy, unexpectedly. As Arijaya said, I work as a freelance editor, and I'd accepted a job editing a book. It was written in French by a Hungarian academic, and it quickly became apparent that this academic had some very weird ideas about French grammar and spelling, and this job was going to take an awfully long time. I'd planned to have a sort of spacious week, meet up with a few friends, and then, yeah, this job happened, and then, the car needed to be taken to the garage for repairs, and then I discovered by chance that the water meter was leaking. And before I knew it, this spacious week had become really quite full and rather stressful. And I started to notice these thoughts bubbling up in my mind. And they were thoughts like, I've got too much to do. I'm too busy. I don't have enough time for myself. I'm feeling under pressure. Why doesn't everyone just leave me alone? And it was quite a tight space to be in. It was quite unpleasant. And I was starting to think about this talk, so I thought, well, how do I approach Vairochana's realm from this kind of state? How can I go towards that? So I decided I was going to practice noticing spaces in my experience. I don't mean what I was thinking about my experience, I mean my actual experience. So these are a few things that I noticed. I got up in the morning, wanted to make a cup of tea, so I had to wait for the kettle to boil. So just that experience of waiting, I thought, oh, well, that's a potential space. A bit later on, I sat down to start work and had to wait for my computer to start. So again, this experience of waiting. A bit later that morning, I had to go and do some shopping. So went out, had to stop at a red traffic light, wait for it to turn green. Did my shopping at the supermarket, was queuing at the till, again had to wait to be served. And then later that evening, I had to come into Cambridge for Mitra study. And there was a really bad accident on Milton Road and a massive traffic jam, and I just got stuck in the middle of it. And I had to sit on Milton Road for about 40 minutes. And as I was sitting there, I was thinking, for a busy day, there's an awful lot of waiting involved. And I thought, well, I can either wait while thinking about what's going to happen next, which is I'm going to be late at Mitra study. I can probably get annoyed about that as well. Or I could just wait. Just see what that experience of waiting is like. And also see if it will open up into something else, if it'll change. And of its own accord, in a way, just open up some kind of space in my experience. I was thinking about entering different realms and cultivating spaciousness and that kind of thing. And I remembered a description I'd read in a book, in a novel. So I said earlier about, you know, with these archetypal figures, what interests me is finding ways of bringing them alive and connecting them to the world that I live in. And for me, that includes what I read and what I see. So this is just an example, really. It's a description from Philip Pullman's novel, The Subtle Knife. And it's the second book in his Northern Lights trilogy. I won't go through the whole story, but I'll just set the scene. And then I'll read the description and explain as I go along how it is that I'm connecting it with the centre of the mandala. So the story, the two main characters are two children, Lyra and Will. And in this novel, they're trying to get hold of the subtle knife. And the subtle knife is a magical knife because it allows you to cut a window into another dimension, to a different world. And at this bit in the book, they've just found it. And it's in the possession of a man called Giacomo Paradisi. And Giacomo Paradisi was a previous bearer of the knife. So he knows how to use it. But there's been a fight and he's been mortally wounded. And this bit that I'm going to read, he's wanting to teach Will how to use the knife. Will's just become the new bearer of the knife. So this is how it starts. As Will picked up the knife, he felt that it was light in his hand and strong and beautifully balanced. This edge of the knife, said Giacomo Paradisi, will cut through any material in the world. The other edge of the knife, the old man went on, is more subtle still. With it, you can cut an opening out of this world altogether. Try it now. Do as I say. Hold the knife out ahead of you, like that. It's not only the knife that has to cut, it's your own mind. You have to think it. So do this. Put your mind out at the very tip of the knife. Concentrate. Focus your mind. Think about the knife tip. That is where you are. Now feel with it. Very gently. You're looking for a gap so small you could never see it with your eyes. But the knife tip will find it if you put your mind there. Feel along the air till you sense the smallest little gap in the world. So basically, Will's standing there and he's holding this knife and the knife tip. And he's feeling the fabric of the world. And he's been told what he's looking for. He's been told what to do. But he's not done it before. He's got no experience of it. So he doesn't know how it feels. So in a way, he doesn't know what he's doing at all. He's just doing it a bit randomly. And I was thinking, well, the fabric of our world is simply our experience. And the knife that we have is our awareness. So in terms of finding a way into the centre of the mandala, finding that smallest little gap in the world, it's about feeling our experience with our awareness and bringing our attention to that. And like Will, if we've not done it before, we're not going to know what we're doing. We're not going to know how it feels. So we might miss little gaps because we don't realise their potential. We don't realise their significance. So it takes practice. So the first time Will does this, he does it really forcefully. He's gritting his teeth and he's sweating and it doesn't work. So this is how the story carries on. Stop, said the old man gently. Relax. Don't push. This is a subtle knife, not a heavy sword. You're gripping it too tight. Loosen your fingers. Let your mind wander down your arm to your wrist and then into the handle. And out along to the blade. No hurry. Go gently. Don't force it. Just wander. Then along to the very tip, where the edge is sharpest of all. You become the tip of the knife. Just do that now. Go there and feel that. And then come back. They watched together as Will's body stopped trembling. No less intense, he was focused differently now. And the knife looked different too. Perhaps it was those cloudy colours along the blade, or perhaps it was the way it sat so naturally in Will's hand. But the little movement he was making with the tip now looked purposeful instead of random. He felt this way, then turned the knife over and felt the other, always feeling with the silvery edge. And then he seemed to find something, some little snag in the empty air. What's this? Is this it? He said, hoarsely. Yes, don't force it. Come back now. Come back to yourself. I felt something there, he said, to Giacomo Paradisi. The knife was just slipping through the air at first, and then I felt it. Good, now do it again. This time, when you feel it, slide the knife in and along. Make a cut. Don't hesitate. Don't be surprised, and don't drop the knife. This time it was easier. Having felt it once, he knew what to search for again, and he felt the curious little snag after less than a minute. It was like delicately searching out the gap between one stitch and the next with the point of a scalpel. He touched, withdrew, touched again to make sure, and then did as the old man had said, and cut sideways with the silver edge. It was a good thing that Giacomo Paradisi had told him not to be surprised. He kept careful hold of the knife and put it down on the table before giving in to his astonishment. Lyra was on her feet already, speechless, because there, in the middle of the dusty little room, was a window. A gap in mid-air, through which they could see another world. So when I was thinking of entering Fyrochina's space, I was thinking, well, there's got to be a massive gate, or a front door at least. I mean, it is Fyrochina's pure land. But what do we do if we can't find it? So that's why I like this description, because it asks us to look for the smallest gap, the gap between one stitch and the next. And once we've found that with the knife of our awareness, just catching the tip of it, then it's a case of shifting our attention and our focus. So in the example I gave earlier, instead of focusing on the busy bits, means shifting my focus to the bits in between, to the spaciousness that is there. I was thinking it's a bit like maybe shifting your weight from one foot to another. Or you could also talk about it in terms of moving from doing mode to being mode. So it's a mental attitude. Having said that, if we are feeling stressed or busy, that's not to say that it might not also be worth looking at the externals and maybe doing a bit less. So this is just looking at the sort of mental aspect of it. I was also thinking in terms of the five aspects of spiritual practice that we have in Sri Ratna. And for me, the realm, the space at the centre of the mandala is all about spiritual receptivity. That's what I associate with it. Okay, so we're now in the centre of the mandala. And this is where we meet Vairochana. There's lots that could be said really about Vairochana, lots of sort of different directions I could have gone in. Visantra in his book mainly talks about the symbolism of the Dharma chakra, so I'm not going to talk about that at all. I'm just going to focus on Vairochana as king and the positive king archetype. So there's lots in the imagery of Vairochana that associates him with kingship. The fact that he's at the centre of the mandala for a start. And then his name, the illuminator, the symbolism of the sun. The Dharma chakra itself is a symbol of sovereignty. And then his animal, the lion, which is always considered to be the king of the animal kingdom. I remember at Bhaja, after my private ordination, I asked to be ordained in the evening, so it was dark. And I remember after the ceremony, walking down the hill to the block where Amachandra and I were sharing a dorm. And I was thinking about my name. So I was thinking about Dhatu, which is the first bit. Dhatu means sphere or realm. And in the context of my name, it means realm of space or sphere of truth, something like that. So I remember thinking, that sounds good. That's good. And then there was Ishvari. And Ishvari means queen or sovereign lady. And I don't know, maybe it was just my French Republican conditioning coming up, but being a queen just didn't strike me as a terribly safe thing to be. And I remember thinking, how is this going to work? So I had to think quite a lot about that, you know, how is this going to work? And I think another way of thinking about this whole topic is to ask ourselves questions like, where do I get my sense of direction from? Who is it who makes the decisions in my inner realm? Who's in charge? So, of course, we're not talking about worldly kings or queens. We're talking about our inner dimension. And in that sense, we're all kings or queens of our own inner world. So the king-queen archetype, it's about centrality. It's about stability. It's about integration. It's about providing guidance. And as a consequence of that, it's also about creating the conditions for fulfillment to unfold and for potential to develop. And again, in terms of the five aspects of spiritual practice, for me, Vairochana in his king aspect is all about integration and positive emotion. So integration being the stability, and then the positive emotion being setting up the conditions for fulfillment. So I think integration is interesting. It's very often talked about in terms of unification. So this idea that you've got lots of different strands and then somehow you weave them together and you end up with just the one. So unifying integration in that sense. But for me, there's another way of thinking about it, which is integration as openness. And in this sense, it's about being aware and being open to our entire experience, the whole of our experience. So it's about, not leaving bits of ourselves out, not cutting bits of ourselves off because we think they're not good enough or they're not acceptable for whatever reason. So for me, that's the kind of integration that Vairochana embodies. And coming back to the symbolism of the sun, in a way, that's what the sun does. The sun just illuminates everywhere in all directions. It doesn't think, oh, I don't like this bit there. I think I'll just not shine there. It just shines everywhere in the entire realm. So we know that Vairochana is a skillful king because he's holding the Dharma chakra. So what that tells us is that he's ruling on the basis of the Dharma and he's ruling on the basis of metta. I've got quite a visual imagination, so I imagine Vairochana holding court. So he's in his lands and he's holding court, and all the people in the realm have been summoned to court. And they've been summoned by Vairochana because he wants to hear the voices of all the people in the land. He wants to know all the perspectives in the realm so that then he can make a decision. So he'll make his own decision, but it'll be based on hearing all sides and all voices. And on the basis of that, he'll make a wise decision about, I don't know, whatever needs to happen in Vairochana's realm. And on the inside, I imagine it's a bit in the same way. I don't know if anyone's seen the film Inside Out, but to me that makes sense, thinking about it in that way. I imagine sort of different characters, different parts of me. So there'll be the sulky part of me and the serious part of me and the playful part and the inspired part. And these are all, we could say, different moods that can come up at different times. And each of those moods has a different perspective on my experience. So relating the Vairochana King archetype to my inner realm basically means developing a part of myself that is able to take the broadest perspective possible, to listen to all the different parts of myself, not cutting any of them off, and then practicing, learning to make a wise decision about whatever needs to happen in my life on the basis of what I've heard. So I was saying earlier, how do we learn to see through the eyes of these figures and become like them? And I think that's how, just by practicing behaving like them. So listening to all the voices in our inner realm and making decisions on the basis of that and on the basis of metta. There's a couple of shadow sides to the king archetype, actually it's probably more than two, but I'll just mention two because I think they can come up in relation to this. So So the first one is the tyrant. So the tyrant has got an agenda. The tyrant wants to impose his or her perspective. The tyrant's not interested in hearing all the voices in the land. So it's quite a sort of willful way to be with ourselves. I think we fall into the tyrant when we're being harsh with ourselves and we're not allowing maybe quieter, more subtle parts of ourselves to have a voice. And then there's the weakling. Now the weakling is almost the opposite. The weakling is very happy to hear all perspectives, but the weakling has trouble then making a decision. So this is where we sort of drift and maybe fall into doubt, indecision, that kind of state. Now I was thinking, well, how do we know who's in charge? How do we know if it's the positive king or the tyrant or the weakling? And the thing is, I don't think necessarily other people will know, so we've got to know for ourselves. I think we've basically got to just be really honest with ourselves. Ask ourselves, do we have any no-go areas that we're not willing to look at? I was thinking also, the parts of ourselves that may not get a voice in our waking life may come up in our dreams. Or they may come up in conversations, in friendships. Maybe if we tend to get reactive about particular issues or topics, is that a sign that we're not being open to the whole of our experience? I don't know, maybe. So, in worldly terms, the monarchy needs to keep renewing itself in order to maintain itself. So when the king or the queen dies, another king or queen will take his or her place. And that's how the monarchy keeps going over generations. But in spiritual terms, it doesn't work like that. In spiritual terms, once the positive king or queen archetype has been established and is working effectively, we need to go beyond it. We need to let go of it. So this is where we move into the territory of Akasha Teshri and her wisdom. We need to realise, actually, there is nobody in charge. There's no separate, enduring self that experience happens to. And in terms of the five aspects of spiritual practice, I think of Akasha Teshri and her wisdom very much in terms of the last two, so spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So spiritual death being that recognition that there is no fixed enduring self, and spiritual rebirth as being the freedom and the release that comes as a response to realising that. I should maybe say that what I'm saying about the spiritual aspects is not traditional to Sri Ratna teaching, it's just my own thoughts, although they make sense to me. So Akasha Teshri's wisdom basically tells us that all things are impermanent, that experience is a constant flow of change, like a stream that's constantly flowing, whether we pay attention to it or not, that's just what it's doing. And there's no separate self that is watching that happen that's separate from that flow. The thing is, we don't live in alignment with that. So the way we treat our experience, we don't sort of accept it as a flow. We don't see it as a flow. We tend to sort of chop it up into different bits. We sort of lift chunks out of the flow and then relate to the bits that we've lifted out as if they're the whole story. In fact, we go further than that because then we identify with those bits that we've lifted out. So with my example earlier about being busy, I'd lifted out the busy bits from my experience. So it wasn't that I wasn't experiencing busyness, I was. But I was lifting those bits out and then relating to them as if they were the whole of my experience. And then I was adding labels and interpretations and judgments, and we do this all the time. And we end up with a sort of interpretation that's got very little to do with the actual flow of experience. We end up with a sort of partial and distorted view of what is really going on. So from the ego's point of view, Akasha Teshri's wisdom is challenging. It's really scary because she's asking us to, well, to let go of interpretations and stories that may be unsatisfactory, but they're familiar and they feel safe. So even though they're painful, we can cling on to these stories because they feel somehow safe. And of course, from Akasha Teshri's point of view, the way we relate to our experience, or we tend to relate to it, is just complete madness. From her point of view, her wisdom is about freedom. She's inviting us to rest in the flow of experience. She's inviting us to let go of the restrictions that we put on ourselves and to enter a space that's vast and boundless, limitless, equal to enlightenment. So sometimes people say to me, they don't relate to these archetypal figures. They feel too foreign or too Tibetan, or just, yeah, they just can't relate to them. But in a way, I think we don't need to necessarily relate to them as figures, because we can just relate to the qualities directly. And the other thing about the mandala, I think people have said this before in this series of talks, the different realms are not, they're not separate countries with fixed border controls. It's much more fluid than that. And I think with the centre of the mandala, maybe in particular, because the centre is what holds the whole thing together, the qualities of the centre actually pervade the entire mandala. I actually think the centre of the mandala and its qualities, in a way, are what support the mandala as a whole. So any of these figures can be used as a gateway into the mandala, and then we'll have access to all of these different qualities. So I'm going to end with something. This is something I do in meditation sometimes. I do it silently, but obviously I'll speak it out this time. What I do is imagine myself sitting in the centre of the mandala, cultivating an attitude of spaciousness and receptivity, just simply being in the presence of Vairochana and Akasha Teshri. And then I call out to myself the qualities, all the qualities of the different realms of the mandala. And I do this as a way of, reminding myself what I'm trying to connect with, and also as a way of trying to get that bigger perspective. So I'll do that now, and then I'll just finish off reading a few lines from a poem that I like called Darkani Song by Leonore Kendall. And it's just the last stanza, actually. I like it because it describes the female figure of this realm in quite a mysterious way. So, I don't know, you might like to imagine yourselves sitting in the centre of the mandala, in this space of simplicity and presence. And I'll call out the qualities starting in the east, and then I'll just work my way around. Clarity. Depth. Awareness. Abundance. Equanimity. Inner wealth, beauty, tenderness, intimacy with experience, appreciation, fearlessness, aliveness, creativity, playfulness. Imagine that within the centre of space, there sits a Darkani angel. Her robes are the white of sunlight on snow, and she wears a necklace of flaming crystals. She is never silent, but her voice is as soft as a falling raindrop. For 1,000 times 1,000 years, She has sung the song of time before time began. She will never be silent until the sky is still.